Welcome to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California, advocating for California's rural counties for nearly 50 years. Hometown California tells the rural story through the eyes of those who live, work, and play in the rural communities of the Golden State. Welcome to Hometown California. I'm your host, Paul Smith. Joining me today is Bob Stern, a renowned and respected name in California politics. Bob is a friend to RCRC for many years. We put on an annual conference, and we usually talk politics in some form or fashion when we have an annual conference. And Bob has attended and participated in those events numerous times to share his insights with attendees of our annual conference. But today we are very fortunate to have him as a guest on the Hometown California podcast. So welcome, Bob. We are so glad that you are here today.
Thanks so much, Paul, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
For those of you who may not know Bob or may be unfamiliar with his work, I'd like to call Bob one of the godfathers of California politics, at least the modern era of California politics, starting in the 60s all the way up to the present. He is probably best known as one of the co-authors of the California Political Reform Act, which the voters adopted in 1974. He has worked for Jerry Brown going back even to those Secretary of State days, and a lot of our listeners probably don't even remember that Jerry Brown was Secretary of the State before governor the first time. He was the first general counsel to the Fair Political Practices Commission. He's done a lot of work in kind of an academic role and a center for government studies. He's just an all-around knowledgeable person of California politics and, more importantly, the mechanizations of California politics. I know that's a glowing introduction of you, Bob. I don't know if you want to add to that or address something that I left out.
No, I think you did a great job. Thank you so much.
So I think that begs the first question, Bob. You've been involved in this process, this, for lack of a better term, industry for 40, 50 years. What got you interested in politics, and you've really focused on political reform? Why so?
Well, my parents probably got me interested because they were involved with the ACLU in New York, with the United Nations and League of Women Voters. I remember that they told me when I was 10 years old they were going to hear Eleanor Roosevelt, and I said, please take me, and they said, no, you're too young. And that's probably one of my biggest regrets ever, is not to have heard Eleanor Roosevelt talk. When we moved to Bakersfield, our vet was Walter Stern, who became a state senator. I was president of the Young Democrats in Bakersfield. And then when I went to Stanford Law School, I took one of the first election law courses offered in the country at Stanford Law School, and then taught legislative problems of the poor as a teaching fellow at the law school after I graduated. And then came to Sacramento in late 1970, was in Sacramento for 13 years, working for Henry Waxman, on the Assembly Elections Committee, Jerry Brown, and as his elections counsel when he was Secretary of State, and then with the FPPC.
Wow. So was it a certain ideological thing? Was it just the love of the game? Was it an axe to grind that your dad took you to City Hall one day? What was that other little spark, or was it just in your blood?
I think part of it was when I was working for the East Palo Alto Legal Aid Office and had clients and trying to solve their problems and finding out that legislation would be a better way of solving their problems than representing them. And so I got interested in Sacramento, taught a course called Legal Problems of the Poor, Legislative Problems of the Poor. And then when I got to Sacramento, Henry Waxman asked me to join his staff as on the Assembly Elections Committee. And so I got involved with that and redistricting. And so Henry Waxman and then Jerry Brown, when he asked me to become his elections counsel at the Secretary of State's office, said to me, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write the best possible campaign disclosure, lobbying and conflict of interest bills that you can. Don't worry about the legislature passing them, because they won't. But I'd like to have this. I might be running for governor. I could use this as a platform. So you write the bills. And I wrote the bills. And as Jerry predicted, they were quickly killed in the legislature. And then a group came to us and said, we're circulating a ballot initiative in this area. Would you look at the initiative? And I said to them, after a couple of days, I called the group in. I said, you know, why are you having the campaign statements filed in the state of Washington? This is, after all, California. They laughed. They said, oh, we copied the Washington State initiative. And I said, well, that's a problem, having the campaign statements filed in Olympia. And I said, there are the provisions of your proposal. They're unconstitutional here in California. They might not be unconstitutional in Washington, but they're unconstitutional here. Why don't you take a look at my three bills and, you know, take the best parts of the bills and put them in your initiative. And after a day or two, they came back and said, tell you what, you take your three bills, put them together, and we'll circulate it as an initiative. And that's how the Political Reform Act came into being. I remember Jerry Brown actually looking at the final draft, going through line by line, saying, why is this comma here? Why is this word here? What is this all about? So Jerry was very much involved with it. The initiative was circulated. Of course, this was Watergate time, and it was put on the ballot in June of 74 and passed by 70% of the vote. And it hasn't changed that much. I mean, it's been 47 years or so, and it hasn't changed that much. The basic structure is there. It's been improved by the legislature, but it still is in operation, much to my surprise.
So I guess the big question, as we stay on the theme of the Political Reform Act of 1974, is it working? Is it working as intended in 1974? Is campaign finance reform as a whole working? And if not, what can we do better?
Well, I think if you look back at the government in the 70s versus government now, it's a much better government that we have today, much more responsive. We have terrific disclosure, campaign disclosure. I think we have good conflict of interest disclosure. We have good lobbying disclosure. And as importantly, we have an agency with the Fair Political Practices Commission that has really been very fair, tough, continues to bring enforcement actions. Unlike the Federal Election Commission at the federal level, this commission is active and doing very well. So overall, I would say that much to my surprise, the Political Reform Act is alive and well. It obviously could be improved. The big problem that we have, of course, is the U.S. Supreme Court, and they have really cut back on what you can do in terms of political reform. You can't have spending limits, for example, on campaigns. You can't limit PACs. You can have contribution limits, but they have to be fairly high. And you can have disclosure. Only Justice Thomas has said disclosure is unconstitutional. The rest of the court, at least up until the last few appointments, has said that disclosure is okay. So I think that we have disclosure. We have now electronic filing, which is terrific. You don't have to go to Sacramento anymore and go through the filing cabinets to look at the campaign statements. You have disclosure on TV and radio ads of who's filing. You know, the biggest change, I think, Paul, from the 70s, of course, is the internet and how now people are making these small contributions and having an impact with the small contributions all across the country. So that's been a very good thing as well.
So I think critics of what you just said would point out that, yeah, we've got good disclosure, we have this, we have that. But the basic premise I think voters have when it comes to campaign finance reform is it's still all about the money. And more importantly, it's about the big, big money, whether it's corporations, it's unions, it's billionaires from Google or billionaires from the Texas oil industry. How do you respond to that criticism, which I hear an awful lot?
Well, it is about the money to a great degree, and that's because the United States Supreme Court has not allowed us to limit the money. But, you know, the candidates who spend the most money don't necessarily win. I mean, Donald Trump spent half of what Hillary Clinton spent in 2016 and won. There were several Senate races this year where the candidate who spent the most money did not win. But, yes, money has an impact on the legislation, unfortunately. And I would love to be able to say you cannot give a campaign contribution and solicit a big campaign contribution and solicit a legislator on a particular bill, but the court won't let me do that. So the best we can do is require disclosure, have an active press showing where there are possible links from the money to the decisions, and then hope that the Supreme Court will wake up some point and say, yes, you can limit campaign contributions. Yes, you can limit expenditures. And you can have public financing. They're all candidates have to take public financing as opposed to large campaign contributions. But I'm afraid that's not going to happen in my lifetime. So I'm afraid I have to live with what we have right now.
So do you think your efforts in campaign finance reform, getting back to what you experienced in politics in California in the 60s and early 70s, was more aimed at corruption in the true sense that we see it today, or we've, you know, you see it in old movies, or was it more about campaign finance reform to make things more competitive?
Yeah, I think it was more about corruption. And that's been my disappointment, is that we have not been able to separate the campaign money from the decisions. I think we have competitive elections. We clearly now in California, with a redistricting commission, have much more competitive elections than we had in the past. Although, of course, the Democrats are really dominating the state. Ever since 1994 with Prop 187, the Democrats have taken over. So the competition many times is between two Democrats and sometimes between two Republicans because of the top two as well. So, yeah, my focus is corruption. That's why public financing, I'm afraid, does not work under the current situation, because even when you take public financing, you're allowed to raise money for your office holder expenses or legal defense funds and things like that. So I guess the success has been the disclosure. The failure has been the fact that we have not been able to separate the link from campaign money to governmental decision making.
And I should just add, RCRC is an active advocate in lobbying the legislature and Congress, but because we are governed by elected officials, we do not do donations. We do not spend money in campaigns, whether they are initiatives or candidates or what have you. So I feel that we can have this discussion without any impunity on RCRC or what it does here in Sacramento and Washington. Let's shift a little bit to the conversation about ballot measures. And I have said on this podcast to a couple of folks that a wise man called Bob Stern once said to me that people don't overturn their electoral decisions willy-nilly. In fact, if it comes to a campaign proposition, show me a proposition that would be overturned by the same electorate if they were given a chance to redo it X amount of years later. And I think 2020's general election campaign proved the Bob Stern maxim that people don't undo their decisions at the ballot box. Insights on why you held that belief years ago and you still hold it today?
Well, I would modify it just slightly by saying that when voters approve a ballot initiative, they very rarely regret approving that initiative. They're not really fooled into passing it. They are fooled into turning it down. But there are a few initiatives that have been changed. The marijuana initiative would be one, where the voters now have voted to legalize marijuana. And the other one that I would point to would be gay rights. In 2000, the voters said no to gay rights by 62% or 60%. In 2008, I think it was 52% they said no. And if you put it on the ballot today, I think the voters would approve gay rights overwhelmingly. But the maxim is that the voters are, I always say, name me an initiative that the voters were fooled into passing. And it's very hard to say that they're fooled into passing. Now, you're right. This year, we had two propositions trying to overturn previous initiatives, Prop 15 dealing with the property taxes and Prop 13, and then Prop 16 with the affirmative action, and which was passed several years ago, banning that, taking into account race when dealing with the governmental decisions. In both cases, the voters said, no, we want to keep this situation the same. Once they decide on something, very rarely overturn what they've done in the past, but occasionally they do. Occasionally they see that things, circumstances have changed, but voters are pretty consistent.
So let's talk about those two ballot measures in November, because the timing is perfect. You know, we're just coming off of the general election. I think we could say safely the Prop 15 measure as it related to 1978's Prop 13, a lot of money influenced the voters there, pro and con. Critics of that process, particularly the proponents of Prop 15, said that they just got outspent and there's just nothing you can do about that, hence why the voters didn't revisit it in the fashion you've described. You can't really say that about Prop 16, which of course would have overturned Prop 209 of 1996 dealing with affirmative action. Maybe shed some light as to your analysis on how your maxim played out in both of those measures.
Yeah, I have another maxim also where a lot of money is spent against an initiative. It's very hard for the initiative to pass. And that happened in Prop 15, where it was about equal spending, but there was a lot of money spent against it. And where money is spent against an initiative, if voters are at all confused, the default position is vote no. And so there are very few initiatives that pass where there's lots of money spent against. Occasionally it happens, but very few. To the contrary, if you spend a lot of money for an initiative, doesn't necessarily mean it's going to pass. And of course, we have Prop 22, where a lot of money was spent. That was the Uber-Lyft one. But with Prop 16, you're absolutely right. There was very little money spent against it. There was a lot of money spent for it. But it was something that voters, I think, understood. And the polls early on showed it was in trouble. This was actually a measure, I think, put on by the legislature as opposed to an initiative. But the voters said, basically, well, we want to keep the situation the same as what it was when we passed it.
And why do you think that's the case? I mean, I know we're getting way into the weeds in one single proposition, but again, to test that Bob Stern maxim, I mean, here you have a measure, Prop 209 in 1996, when the state was very white, much whiter than today. 24 years later, the ethnicity composition of California is much more diverse. It's not just Latinos, it's Asians and a whole host of ethnic and minority groups, women obviously much more empowered than they were 24 years ago. What is it about that maxim that you think really sunk Prop 16?
I think a lot of it was the wording of it. People really believe in equality. They believe that race shouldn't matter. I think a lot of Asians were concerned about being admitted to the University of California, where Asians have a much higher percentage than their population. Latinos did not turn out to support it the way people thought they would. So there are a whole bunch of reasons for it. I was not surprised when it went down. I was disappointed that it went down, but I wasn't surprised.
So do you think this is a lesson that interest groups that play in the initiative world are going to look at and adhere to? Or do you think it's just what it is and people will roll the dice regardless of what grievance they want to take to the initiative process?
Well, again, this was, I think the legislature put this on the ballot, as I recall.
They did.
So it wasn't an initiative. It was trying to overturn an initiative, as I remember. No, I think that people, if it doesn't take a whole lot of money if you're wealthy to put an initiative on the ballot. If you have $3 million, you can almost get anything on the ballot. The problem is passing it once you get it on the ballot, however. But that's the problem we have with the initiative process, in a sense. Grassroots organizations that don't have money have a tough time getting their initiatives on the ballot. Big interest groups that have lots of money don't have much trouble getting it on the ballot. Now, again, they have to pass it, and that's always a problem. There were a couple of initiatives a few years ago where groups were spending $20 or $30 million supporting the initiative and still failed with no opposition against it. There's a Mercury Insurance Initiative and I think a PG&E initiative, and very little money was spent against them, and they failed. So the problem is that we see initiatives that are put on the ballot by big special interests, and sometimes they pass. Uber, Lyft being the best example, although they spent over $200 million shattering all sorts of records in terms of supporting it. But in terms of the Prop 16, the voters, I think, understood what they were voting on and said, we want to keep the situation the same. We like equality. We don't want to give one group an advantage over another group.
So do you think that the legislature will think twice and start also adhering to the Bob Stern maxim? Or do you think the legislature is going to do what the legislature is going to do?
No, I don't. I think that if people have ideas, you know, after all, we only had 12 measures on the ballot this time. I know my class was saying 12 measures, that's too many. You know, one year we had 30 measures on the ballot. So this was a kind of a small year in the sense of the ballot measures. So I think that people who circulate initiatives and the legislature, it doesn't cost the legislature anything to put it on the ballot, maybe a little bit of pride if they lose. But I don't even know who the author was of Prop 16, so I'm not sure that that person suffered at all by the loss.
Well, she is going to be our next Secretary of State, Dr. Shirley Weber from San Diego. So it'll be very interesting how that transition goes.
You'll have to ask her that question.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that will come up when the legislature confirms her appointment to the Secretary of State positions. Let's shift gears here. You know, I alluded to the fact that you've been around politics a long, long time in California. You've seen...
You said the 60s, by the way. I think that's a little... stretching it a little bit too much. I would say starting the 70s.
Okay, we'll split some hairs there, Bob. What little hairs that we have left.
I'm not that old.
So you obviously were very active in what we call Jerry Brown 1.0. You obviously have lived through Jerry Brown 2.0 and everything in between. What are some of your observations, both getting down to the nitty-gritty of Jerry Brown himself, but also just the body politic and the nature of California politics?
Well, there's just a huge difference between Jerry Brown 1 and Jerry Brown 2. After all, he was the youngest governor of California ever elected, and he was the oldest governor of California ever elected. And when he was young, he was running for president, and I was young with him at that point, and we had some ideas, and he had trouble getting along with the legislature. He wasn't in the state that much because he was running for president. He did some very good things, Agricultural Labor Relations Board, Small is Beautiful. He had some ideas, I think maybe were a little bit ahead of California's ideas. And then, of course, Prop 13 came about in 1978, and he became known as Jerry Jarvis because he embraced Prop 13 once it passed. And then he lost to Pete Wilson in 1982 for Senate, so he had some rough times. His second time around, he was spectacular as governor. He had really matured. He really understood things. I think Californians had caught up with him, and he just did a terrific job as governor. So my hat is off to Jerry Brown, too.
The complete absence of viable Republicans in the state of California continues to astonish me. Yes, I know they made a little bit of a comeback with those House seats in 2020, but by and large, they have become almost irrelevant in the state in the sense that there's almost a three-quarters majority of Democrats in both houses of the legislature. One of the things, Bob, that's amazed me in my political lifetime, which dates probably the mid-80s up till now, and obviously it goes back further for you, is that the Republican Party has become irrelevant in the state of California. They don't have one statewide office. Their legislature is three-quarters Democrats. Their congressional delegation, notwithstanding 2020, is just lopsided. It's almost 4-1. What's your sense about California democracy when it's one party state and you just don't have that lore of an opposition that produced Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, some incredible leaders, whether you agree with them ideologically or not? You just have lost that lore. What are your thoughts on that? And what other things have you noted in those 50 years?
Well, there's a major change that occurred in 1994, I think. And that's when we had Prop 187 on the ballot, sponsored by Pete Wilson. Even though he won and Prop 187 won, it really energized the Latino vote in California. And Alex Padilla, our new senator, has said that Prop 187 was the reason he went into politics after having graduated from MIT in engineering. So I think that really had a huge impact on California. There's a terrific book called Texas versus California by Ken Miller from Claremont McKenna College that I'm reading right now. And he compares the two in showing how Texas at one point was completely Democratic and California was completely Republican, and how things have really reversed. Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor just a few years ago. I don't rule out the Republicans coming back. But at this point, of course, the Democrats do control. There are a lot of moderate Democrats, however, who moderate the party. And it all depends a lot on the governor, Governor Newsom. And, you know, there could be a recall of Governor Newsom. They're circulating a ballot measure right now. They've collected, I think, over half the number of signatures needed. If somebody comes in and finances the rest of the recall, it's very likely that in the summer or fall of 2021, we may have another recall election.
Do you really think that's viable, given we're in such a different place than we were in 2003?
Yeah, I really do think it is viable, that people are so upset with politicians that they tend to vote no. And if Newsom has a few more French Laundry, the restaurant where he attended the dinner with his friends in violation of his rules, if he has that, if the COVID vaccine doesn't do well, if the state is still shut down in the fall of next year, if the economy doesn't come back, I can see him being recalled. Now, the question is, there's not another Arnold Schwarzenegger yet, but there could very well be somebody who emerges that becomes very popular and takes over. So if I were in Governor Newsom's office, I would be taking this very, very seriously, despite the fact that he's much more popular than Gray Davis was when he was recalled. Well, there's a long ways to go, and hopefully things will turn around in 2021 for everybody so that we're all vaccinated and we're all able to return to our normal lives. But if not, I can see politicians being tossed out.
What else stands out in your tenure of being an observer and to a certain degree a practitioner of California politics? Would it be Prop 13 in 1978, that year that Pete Wilson ran those ballot measures that kind of galvanized ethnic groups? What are the other notable landmarks that you've observed?
Yeah, I mean, Prop 13 would be the biggest one. Political Reform Act, obviously, in 74 was a big one. Prop 187 was a big one. I think there are two that emerged, and Governor Schwarzenegger had a lot to do with it, and that's the Redistricting Commission. Very important, I think, for California. When I was working for Henry Waxman, he was chairman of the Assembly Elections Reapportionment Committee. I didn't work on reapportionment, but he said, Bob, please come in and be my witness as legislators come in to plead their case for their districts. So I would just sit there. He said, don't say anything, just sit there. So I would sit there and legislators would come in, Henry, you know, draw my district so that my mother-in-law is in my district, or in one case, so she's outside of my district. Henry, make sure my major contributors are in the district or the university is in my district. But every one of the legislators that came in said, Henry, make sure I win my next election. And I came away from that, and actually so did Henry Waxman later, saying anybody but the legislature should do redistricting. Anybody, it doesn't matter who. And of course, in 2008, 2010, we set up a new commission to do the redistricting. I think they did a terrific job the first time around. We're going to see what happens this next time around. So that's one. Number two is the top two, where the top two finishers in the runoff, as opposed to the top Democrat, top Republican. You saw that Dianne Feinstein was faced by Kevin DeLeon in this last election, two Democrats, 2018, two Democrats running against each other. We may see that again. So those are two big changes, I think, in California. The other change that's going to be coming up is California is losing population in terms of other states. And so we may see one or two fewer congressmen in California. So California's clout may be a little bit less, and Texas' clout may be a little bit more because of population shifts. And of course, we see California being a rather high tax state. And the question is whether California can continue to raise money from the millionaires, billionaires that have come here in Silicon Valley, Silicon Beach. But I'm optimistic about California. I think California is going to emerge from this just fine. People are still going to come here. People are going to experience the dream of California. And I think we're, once this COVID crisis is over, I think we'll be in much, much better shape.
So let's talk about COVID for a little bit and get your thoughts on how it is impacting the state, particularly its politics. You mentioned that obviously if the recall of Gavin Newsom gets some legs, that the dynamics of COVID could enter into that and who knows, perhaps be the downfall of his governorship. What else do you think is impacting the body politic that can be directly linked to COVID-19?
Well, I think the shame of it has been the fact that COVID crisis has become a political crisis and divided the people as opposed to unifying the people. But unfortunately, I think because President Trump is a divider as opposed to a unifier, that hasn't happened. If all of us could be wearing masks, all of us could be vaccinated, this thing would be over. We'd have the economy booming again in California. But that's been a big problem. And of course, the division has been a big problem where people can't talk to each other. In my classes that I teach, I try to get Republicans, because my classes are mainly liberal Democrats, because this is the west side of Los Angeles. I try to get Republicans to speak up. I try to represent them. I try to invite Republicans to come in to speak to my class, because I think it's important that we hear the other side. We may not have to agree with the other side, but at least we should be listening to what they're saying, because they do have important things to say. So that's, I guess, my big problem today is we have such huge divisions. I have to give President Trump one big victory, and that is he has made people interested in politics. I mean, I have classes now of 200 people attending my classes, all because of President Trump. I sort of kiddingly said a few years ago when I taught a class called The Trump Presidency, The Good, The Bad, and The Unknown, how many of you would be taking my class if this were the Pence presidency? And, people sort of shake their heads and not as interesting as the Trump presidency. So Trump at least has generated tremendous interest in politics. We had this tremendous turnout of voters. Now, of course, the division is the big problem. And if Biden can bring people together, that will be a huge, huge thing for this country.
Yeah, I kid a lot of folks by saying Saturday Night Live owes so much to Donald Trump, mainly ratings and viewership. And it sounds like that has transcended even into the academic world. Last final thoughts, Bob, before we let you go.
I think it's important for all of us to stay involved in politics. Biden will not be as interesting as Trump. It'll be more of a boring president. But I think we need to be following what's going on there. I think politics is just so important for all of us. And of course, your listeners, if they're listening to this podcast, probably agree with me on that. But I hope everybody stays involved. I hope the interest is still there in 2022 and 2024. I mean, after all, it's only a few more years before we have another presidential election. And perhaps we might have two Indian Americans facing each other for president, two Indian American women facing each other in Kamala Harris and Nikki Haley.
It could be very interesting. Bob, thank you for your time today. And again, appreciate all that you have done for RCRC, the meetings that you've attended and been a panelist, and just sometimes helping our governmental advocacy team with some thoughts about politics in the current day. Once again, I hope we can connect face-to-face sometime soon as we get out of this pandemic, and perhaps our roads will come together as we move through them. Thank you so much for your time today. Keep doing the good work and keep the faith going.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Hope to see you soon.
You've been listening to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California. Subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and be sure to rate and review this podcast. I'm your host, Paul Smith, and thanks for listening.